So welcome along to another episode of Fundamental Golf. Today we have another guest, and it's Simon Shanks, who is an elite PGA coach. I think I've got that right. But coached on the European Tour, Ladies European Tour, all over the shop, and I presume locally as well. So obviously we're joined by Emma as well. So Emma, say hello again, please.
Good morning, everyone.
And hello, Simon. How are you?
Hi, Ben. Hi, Emma. Yeah, thanks a lot for having me on. Yeah, I'm good. Still in my isolation station. So just, you know, one more week before, well, I don't know what time stamp it, but yeah, one more week before we can go back out on the 29th and chase a white ball around a field instead of just walking around a field for last year. So we did get some golf in the summer, didn't we? But it'd be nice to get back out there again. I'm looking forward to it.
How excited are you?
I think that's quite a sort of a good question, really, in terms of being a golf coach for 20 years. I think it's quite easy to sort of think, well, you know, I don't really want to go and play golf after giving, you know, a full day of lessons, or recently, you know, traveling away for a week and then coming back and saying to the family, oh, I'm just going to go off and play golf this weekend. I'll see you on Monday morning. But I have missed it. It's kind of that thing of, like, you know, really missed, you know, playing golf, that sort of feeling of, you know, just hitting a chip off a tight line, you know, trying to hit a nice spinny one close to the hole. That kind of, that sort of tactile side of it, really, that sort of, you know, just getting back into, you know, what I did when I was a kid, you know, my old club at West Wilts, you know, I've walked around there a couple of times during lockdown and sort of thinking, oh, just, I'll play anywhere right now. And it'd be just that fun side of it I'm missing, really. I'm not any ideas of, you know, competing on the West region again, but just, you know, go out there, play with some friends and have a bit of a laugh. It's exactly what I need right now.
Well, I'm glad you said about, like, West Wilts. So for people that don't know, I've known Simon since we were junior. It was junior golf, wasn't it? Or like Kingdown Golf or something. We won't talk about ages. Yeah, we won't talk about timeline that way.
In our youth,
in our much younger days. So we played a load of golf together. And then you and Tim, like, helped me as a junior, because obviously there wasn't any other girls. So I always thought our group was really nice, friendly, welcoming. And then, like, Joe's and Jimmers of the world turned up. And then it was just our junior group was really nice. And I was just saying to Ben, I can't really remember the timeline, because I went to Hartbury then. And we still caught up quite a lot, because I can't really remember when you turned pro, but I know you used to play loads and you were, like, such a good player. And then I always remember you got hole in one on the first, didn't you, at West Wilts, or you kind of got close to it, which is a par four and disgusting.
it was one of those where you just nip out to play seven holes just at the end of, you know, closing the shop, and then whipped up on the first tee and hit my first shot and it went towards the flag. I thought that was great. Walked up and, you know, pitch mark 3 paces in front. And it must have given the flag a bit of a rattle, to be honest, but it went in. So
it came. It was incredible. I think you were the first person that I'd ever heard get a hole in one on a par four. And I think that were you working in a pro shop then? Is that, were you?
Yeah, I think I can't remember if I'd started as a, doing my traineeship, or it was a case of, I was just doing a bit of, you know, Saturday work to help out the pro, but yeah, it was one of the, yeah, great.
That's incredible. What a stat. What a stat to have on the old resume or CV. That's unbelievable. How long was the hole?
Yeah. It's only 280 uphill. It's uphill into the wind.
It's a bit longer than that, isn't it?
It's a gentle start, isn't it? It's a gentle start at West Wilts.
It is covered by bunkers, and sometimes the wind at West Wilts is ridiculous. So
that's not making it sound hard, is it?
I'm going to say it's really, really hard. But so I don't know. I was trying to work out when. So you turned pro. Did you do your assistant job at West Wilts, or were you somewhere different then? You went to Kingston.
So I started it at West Wilts, and I think I did about 6 months, and the head pro then, Andy Lamb, had got himself a job up in Scotland, I think near Dundee. So I was sort of 6 months in, so I had to find somewhere else to do my training. So kindly, well, I luckily got a job with Andy Butler at Kingsdown. So I was there for, I think, 4 years, 5 years in the end. You know, great club, really nice golf course, quite underrated one, really. And since I left there in 06, and they've now got a really good, you know, a really nice driving range, short game area. And the golf course is always, you know, the greens are always superb in the summer. So it was a really good place to be, really friendly membership. It's just, you know, a bit of an old school club in terms of, you know, it's just all about the golf, you know, small pro shop. Andy, we did really well in terms of, you know, selling equipment out of there. Yeah, he was a really good coach as well. So it was a great place to learn from. He spent quite a bit of time with Dennis Pugh. So I've sort of got the idea, sort of got a few ideas from Andy and piggybacked off a little bit of that and to help formulate my own ideas. We were always sort of, well, back then it was, we were using handheld cameras, and we could then take the tape out of the camera, put it into a, I think actually might have been VHS tapes at the time, put them straight into a small TV with video.
I thought we weren't going to mention age, but I think you've just given it away.
We'd then use a dry line marker pen and draw on the screen.
Yes.
So that was the sort of first way of getting into looking at golf swings. And I think, you know, I was always looking at Tiger or, I could date myself now, or Jim Furyk or any of these guys, just to sort of, you know, that was the best way we could look at it rather than just looking at, you know, some of the, you know, there's this really good Golf Digest book that had, you know, all the top 100 players in the world sort of swing sequences. But apart from that, you couldn't go onto YouTube or Instagram or,
we had nothing, sound
like an old
we?
Guy, really. But yeah,
no, it's kind of, yeah.
It was a bit of a, like, a bit of a whim of, you know, that thought, you know, that feeling, or, you know, rather than now, it's like, well, you know, your pressure trace, your biomechanics, your TrackMan data, and all of that is a bit more eye and a bit more feel to start with, I think. Mm.
There's so much available to the amateur golfer or even the professionals in terms of the equipment you can, if you talk about the TrackMans, the everything else that's going on. But then you've got the YouTube, they'd show my age there. The YouTube.
It's got a new name.
TheYouTube.com, yeah. YouTube. And you could just trawl for hours and hours and hours of just swing after swing after swing and coach after coach after coach. And it's just so much information. And really quickly question, this is not one of the planned questions. Do you think it's gone too far on the YouTube thing? Can people, well, not YouTube itself, can people get stuck into it too much in terms of the amateur golfer?
Well, I don't want to, you know, you're going to sound like a bit of a, oh, you got to go and have a lesson with your home coach to get the right information. But I still think that is really key. What I do like about the stuff on YouTube is there's a lot of good, you know, PGA pros, coaches, that become really successful on there, like Mark Crossfield, Rick Shields, and there's lots of other guys and girls. And I think they've done a really good job at keeping people in the game in terms of, you know, if they're not going to go and have a lesson with someone like myself or Emma, there is something there for them to get some information from. They've got to be really good at identifying maybe their own faults to be able to get the correct answer on YouTube.
That's what I was going to ask, because because I'm obviously a proper amateur golfer, can't do anything really, but I don't understand what my swing feels like or what it's like. I like to know that I do, and it's not until I see it on camera I'm like, oh, I do that. I didn't realise I did that. So having that understanding of what you're doing is really, really important, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, even tour pros that I've worked with, they've, you know, they said, well, I do this and my ball's doing that. And some of the time they're right, but some of the time they're a little bit out, and you have to, and that's the same with any golfer. You know, that feel versus real is always going to be the thing that's going to be difficult for the player to do. You know, no matter, I've done it myself, you know, looked at things, you know, got intrigued by something that I've seen or put it into practice myself. And that's where my own game's gone completely out the window, because I use it as a testing ground for different theories or, you know, different ways the wrist might move, or pivot or things like that, just to sort of get an idea myself. And I've done it before with the, you know, iPad off a tripod and worked away, hit balls, well, that feels good. And it's just the same thing that I've always done. That's that thing, you can swear that you're doing something yourself. But that's where, you know, you can use video. You can all really start into, you know, look pretty, I'll put it on Instagram, and that's all I need to do. But, you know, there's so much more to it than, you know, how the swing looks and, you know, can you hit the shot you want to hit? Can you control the golf ball, how far it goes? Not just how straight it is, can it go the right distance? You know, there's so much to it. But I think it's a really good, you know, I think it's, you know, the YouTube and Instagram and all those things, I think it's kept golf almost alive a little bit to a certain person. I think in one of your podcasts, I think, Andy Law from Adidas?
Yeah.
And he was saying that, you know, there's a growth in sort of like the 20s and 30s and slightly older ladies that, you know, that are getting into the game. I definitely think the 20s and 30s is definitely from, you know, social media and the availability of information. You know, a net is a lot cheaper than it used to be, a map you can get hold of. You know, everyone in the first lockdown were hitting shots in their back garden. It felt, you know, you had to look on Twitter, Facebook, you know, Instagram. Everyone was working away at it. You thought, well, that's fantastic. You know, no one was doing that before. Will that continue? It'd be interesting. You know, before, if you had a net at home, you're a bit of a tragic golfer, weren't you, really? You know,
but we couldn't get out.
Certainly, if you had it in the garage, you know, you'd go. Yeah. But, you know, it's a bit of that thing for a man. We all like a bit of a man cave and go away and do our own thing. It would be interesting to see if that continues. And I think that's born out of, you know, the access to all these different guys out there. I know I like looking on YouTube or certainly Instagram. I feel like I've certainly during these lockdowns wasted some of my life
hours looking
at things.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's not been great, but, you know, I've done a bit of, you know, over these lockdowns, I've done a bit more sort of my own education on certain elements of golf and on the golf swing and things. And that's been nice to have that time to be able to do that. So I think with that time, and you're going to, you know, I think this must have been a social media boom during this lockdown. It might have been harder to produce the stuff, but I think people consuming it when there's time, you know,
you hit the nail on the head, aren't we? Yeah, the accessibility of golf online, and you talk about people on YouTube like the Rick Shields. I think he's got something like 1.7 million subscribers on YouTube. And if you even remove that from the golf side of things, that is a social influencer on the next level of anything. If you talk about any subject, that's a big, big amount of numbers. So that's 1.7 people that are accessing golf that might not have done. And then you've got them. Or they've got, obviously, the James Robinson, is it Robson or Robinson, I can't ever remember. He's got a load of followers on there, Mark Crossfields. But then you go to the other end of the scale, the golfers that aren't coaches, they're just playing golf, like GM Golf, have you seen those? GM Golf and Good Golf. They're American lads, they're all youngsters. When we were talking to Andrew Law last week, they're the guys that popped into my head because they're like 18, 19, 20, 21, 22-year-old guys, all wearing backwards hats, hoodies, playing golf. And they're some of the best golfers I've ever seen on the blooming internet. They're unbelievable golfers. And they've got over 1 million followers and subscribers. And they're all doing trick shots and all sorts. They're if you watch those, I don't understand how two or three of them aren't professional golfers. They are ridiculously good. You've seen them, haven't you, Ev? They are.
Yeah, to be fair, golfers, striking ability. But that probably comes back to a conversation we're probably going to have later about what makes a tour player versus what makes a very good amateur.
Absolutely,
But they have got some talent. It's scary.
I mean, I don't need anybody else to try and follow on social media at the moment. I think, you know.
need to rein it down a bit.
And do what I'm doing. But then there's so much opportunity with it. But it, you know, like you guys in terms of with your podcast, how do you reach the people you want to reach to listen to your podcast? And it's the same, you know, right away when you become a self-employed coach, which I sort of took that sort of step a bit more self-employed at the end of the 2000s, and all of a sudden you think, well, how do I reach the guys who want to go and get better at golf? it's quite an interest. Well, it's more the business of coaching rather than, you know, how to coach, what to coach, you know, what swing models you use or what technology you use. If you can't get people, you know, in your lesson diary, you know yourself, Emma, that you're not much of, you know, you could have all the information in your mind about what to coach, how to coach. You could be a stack and tilt coach, MORAD coach, or a Ledbetter coach. If you haven't got those skills to be able to get people into the game and to enjoy it and enjoy the experience, then and get them to keep coming back, then that's really the sort of, that's the trick of it. And you look at those guys on it, you know, any social media or influencer, people come back and listen to it and watch the videos and listen to their podcasts and interact with them. So there's lots to be learned from the ones that aren't doing really well, you know. And you, I think you could sort of filter that back to a, you know, anyone who's sort of, you know, self-employed or you're trying to make something in this game, sort of an entrepreneurial sort of idea. So I think that's, you know, I think that's really good.
Do you think your time with Andy helped, like, your, like, build you as a golf coach in terms of business and stuff? Because obviously he is around this area, he's pretty much, like, him and Rich Blake business wise were on it. So do you find that that kind of helped your building of you as a coach business wise, not obviously anything?
Yeah, I think at the time, I don't know, I think because I think the numbers kind of scared me in terms of, you know, how much stock, you know, there was in the shop. And then, you know, but, you know, we sold it, but it was like, I couldn't, you know, get my head around at the time. Maybe I didn't think my thought process wasn't sort of like very, I didn't dream very much. Do you know what I mean? I didn't think, oh, I could do that and look at what I could achieve. I just got a bit scared by it. So I thought, got a bit turned off by going down the club pro route just because of the, you know, at the time that, you know, I don't think golf was in a great place at the time. You know, some people were doing incredibly well, yet other places weren't. And I don't know, perhaps I didn't have the confidence myself, even though I thought how it could be really well done. I just don't know if I thought, well, I'm not sure if I'm going to do that. And at the time, you know, then, you know, got together with Sarah and then we got married later on. And I think I was a little bit risk adverse, and that kind of makes what I've done in the last 5-6 years quite ridiculous that I've got involved in, because, it, you know, 10 years ago, I was quite risk adverse and thought, well, if someone would just pay me a salary, I'd be really happy. And then, you know, getting to Bowood, I did 6 months working sort of a little bit of shop and coaching. And then I sort of really got a taste for really getting into coaching and making it my sort of career. And yeah, just didn't really kind of, I don't know, look back from that. And I've been self-employed and kind of had no real security, you know, like a 9-to-5 job, you know, relied on Sarah being our rock in that regard. And yeah, I suppose some of that entrepreneurial spirit that Andy had and his, obviously his coaching ability as well, sort of did rub off, but in a different way, in kind of a bit later on down the line, in terms of just building a coaching business rather than, you know, I couldn't see myself. I could just see how much effort Andy put into it, or all the pros I know put into selling golf equipment for quite little margin, if you like. You think, yeah, you know, it became a massive numbers game. But you speak to, you know, Richard Blake at Uphaven, I mean, and Andy, and, you know, Tony Valentine's done it a different way, and, you know, John Jacobs, it come, you know, local guys to us in Wiltshire. They do fantastically well. And I just, you know, I think at some point, you've got to try and decide on what your direction is going to be. And I didn't see it in the shop.
Funny you mentioned Tony Valentine. So so many people I know will drive from where we are. Obviously, we're only in Bristol, but we'll drive just to go and see Tony Valentine. Oh, they've got all the stuff there in the shop. You can go and have a look at this and that. And he's got a couple of stores on the dotted around. And so many people go over there and check it out.
It's
ridiculous. It's crazy.
It's amazing. I mean, I'd never got in there until quite recently. because it kind of, I was always, you know, whoever I worked for seemed to be a bit of a competitor. So I thought, well, out of loyalty, you know, I won't go in there. But luckily, a friend of mine started working in there, Nick Brennan. And you know, I've been in a few times. It is an amazing place to go. You know, it's, you know, but, you know, it's amazing. But, you know, then there's part of me think, well, you know, the club pro, you've got to support those guys. You know, they're at your club. They're going to know your game the best.
Do you think it is that's the way because they go to these big places because they've got so much stock because people are quite impatient when they order stuff from their pros and it takes maybe 1 or 2 weeks to get in and they just want it there and then so that they can go and smash it on Saturday morning when they go and tee off?
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to look at, you know, at home, isn't it? You know, what do you need? Oh, just go on to Amazon and I can get that set of brushes for the sink or whatever. It'll be there tomorrow. Don't have to go. Certainly in the last year or whatever. There is that element. We're all impatient. We all want it now. I think that's where, you know, I think, you know, the best pros have gone down the route of, you know, really getting into their custom fitting. You know, you've seen lots of indoor bays, you know, Trackman or GC quads, you know, indoors, being able to fit, getting the right, you know, equipment in the hands of the person in front of them. I think that's got to be the way for the club pro to go. Otherwise, you know, you're competing on price and availability. And if you can jump in the car half an hour, pick up the club you want, come back again, then that
always wins.
That's a big asset, isn't it?
Yeah.
But you know, certainly from what I've seen latterly working with the guys on the tour, and they, you know, they've got, well, back before COVID, they had all the, you know, the Callaway van, the Mizuno van, Ping, Titleist, and what they can do fitting wise, I mean, that's really at a high end. It's amazing. It's not just the case of, you know, just twisting the shaft in a puzzle and off we go. You know, different weights of shaft stiffness, that kind of thing. That's kind of what you see every day in, you know, sort of normal fitting to the club golfer, but there's sort of like a further end up there that's certainly new to me and stuff that I'd never thought about, and sort of I didn't have those kind of ideas that's available. So if it makes a massive difference to a guy who's already hitting it 300 through the air, hitting fairways, or they're just looking to hit, you know, another 2% of fairways or finding 5 yards, then, you know, for your club golfer, if they're using something that's not right for them, you know, it could be a massive change to their game, as well as, you know, golf coaching, obviously.
Emma's obviously a great coach for me, but I had quite recently, I had a fitting, didn't I? It was probably my first ever iron fitting, and I was using a set of irons that were almost off the shelf. Well, I kind of had like a semi-fitting where I did like a little bit and thought, oh, that'll do, and I'll go off and have that sorted. And I was playing, doing my thing. Then I went and got a proper fitting and compared my clubs, old clubs, to my current clubs, and the dispersion rate went from about this down to about this. And I was like, I can't believe that's just happened from 1 degree upright and different shaft and this and that. And I was like, that's just ridiculous. How has it gone from that to that? It's an eye opener, especially as an amateur golfer, to see that that can happen to you. It's impressive. It's really impressive.
Yeah, I definitely. You know, and I think, you know, I felt that, you know, when I was coaching a lot more at the club and coaching sort of more beginners and things, I think at the start it was a case of a standard set of clubs will be okay until you get to a level where you've got more of a consistent sort of swing pattern and you kind of got a bit more idea about where the ball's going. When you're not more worried about contact, you're not worried about the flight. I think, you know, then custom fitting really isn't important.
Did you do much custom fitting when you got to Bowood? Or did you, you were predominantly more coaching, would you just give the custom fitting side to Nick and the boys in the shop? Or
I did some. Yeah, certainly when I get, I think, I bought my second-hand Trackman, I think, in 2013. So I started to do a bit more then when you can actually show, you know, the sort of dispersion and all the data from through the Trackman. That became a lot easier. to do that. So that was early on. That was, you know, really, really good. And then some of the other guys, I think they've got their own flight miles, and that helped, you know, some of those guys got involved in that. But I think as soon as you've got that bit of technology to be able to give things a value, you know, show that this iron's 10 yards further and, you know, your dispersion's 5 yards smaller, that's a big help to see it. You know, when it's out there on a big driving range, rather than going, oh yeah, that feels good. Do you know what I mean? You've got something to actually...
You've got data to back it up.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Just about to say that, like we were talking about social media and YouTube earlier, data is everywhere, all over the big guys when they're talking about new clubs that have just come out. I'm doing this, it's this spin mate, it's that. And people are learning a lot more about that, especially the amateur golfers. So they do want to know those numbers. So if you've got that all at hand, just go, well, these are your numbers. This is what they were before. Yeah. This is what they are now. It's a great selling point as well, isn't it, from you guys? Because it's easy just to say, there it is. That's what it is. That's the difference.
Yeah, I think people, you know their club head speed, their ball speed. They know, you get some, I can know early on when I did invest in the TrackMan, and you get one or two clients come in and they really pushed you in terms of what they knew. And you're like, oh, right, that's good. Or certainly when it came to tech, when it came to club tech, because because it moves so quickly, and they say, oh, I've gone for this iron because it launches it low and spins it more, or certainly in that sort of regard, I then felt well, you've really got to be on top of the equipment technology side of things and how quickly things change, and stay on top of it to be able to understand what your customer's using, because you've got to you need to know. And I think that's a big part of it, as well as the coaching piece, is you'd be staying up to date with what people are using and what they're looking for in their game.
Do you find so your timeline that we were talking about, so you're at Bowood 2013
so
when did you, like, how did the tour come about? I know did you teach Jordan from a junior? Is that how that relationship started?
Yeah, so got to Bowood in September 2006, and then over that winter I met after 2006-07 I met Martin and Jordan, and at the time Jordan just wanted a little bit of help with his with some short game. He was already, I can't remember who else he was seeing locally, and we did some work over on the short game over the winter, and he was, he could really play a really nice sort of low spinning wedge shot, but at the time he was kind of limited to that kind of, like, drive it in low and it would spin. And we know the short game is not just about one shot, we've got to be able to play a variety of them. So he worked away that winter, and he kept improving. And one of the other pros at the time that Bode was working with, the other young lads, they both were going to go and play at Royal Porthcawl in the Faldo series. So we all went along, played, four of us played. I think I was playing there later in the year as well. Great fun, great golf course. As we were going around, it sort of looked like Jordan was playing really well, but kind of looked a little bit lost at the time. We'd seen a couple other coaches at the same time, and I just took it upon myself and said, well, that what I see is that there's a huge amount of talent there, but just look a little bit lost. Maybe there's a bit too much information going in to the player, more than one coach, and it's maybe a bit too much. And at the time, looking back, it feels like I took quite a bit of a chance in terms of how it's turned out latterly. And I said, well, look, there's a lot of information going on. Everyone that Jordan's working with is really knowledgeable and doing a really great job, but perhaps you might need to rein it back and just work with one person so that the message is a little bit more succinct, a bit more clear. So I spoke with Jordan and Martin at the time, and a week later they came back and they said, well, you're at Bowood, let's work with you and we'll go from there. And that was sort of 2007-08. Looking back, it's like one of those, when he was sliding doors, conversation away, and I might not be sitting here talking to you about this. I might be talking about how good my beginner program's going or something like that. But it was something I felt, that I always like to feel that during the lesson, I always find myself I'm an honest sort of person, maybe at the detriment of sometimes of the player feeling great about their game, or maybe sometimes a little bit too honest or a bit too harsh on them. But, and that's something I'm aware of in my own coaching, that, you know, sometimes I could try and make things a little bit more fun rather than I get a bit too, you know, maybe a bit too sort of task driven and a bit too much in sort of high expectations, I guess. So that conversation went that way, and then the timeline sort of went on, and he, you know, kept playing well in sort of England A squad, England squad. And then in 2013, in the summer, he won the Brabazon Trophy, up at Formby, which was fantastic. And then all of a sudden, we're talking like Walker Cup later that year. And in the meantime, you know, Jordan had won sort of, you know, amateur events, you know, national ones, and done really well in the Faldo series. He got to the final 2 or 3 years. Really good chance to win it 1 year. And it just sort of kept going and going. And then we were at the Walker Cup, which was an amazing place, a place called the National Golf Links of America, which is one of the sort of the oldest golf courses there. And there's these stories that the course designer sort of arrived there on a boat and found this land and decided he was going to... And in this golf course is... I don't think it's too small. You couldn't hold a US Open on it, but it was perfect for something like the Walker Cup. Next door's Shinnecock Hills, the road. Yeah, so it's an amazing spot of land. And yeah, that was a fantastic week. Unfortunately, America won. And at the time, I didn't really pay any attention to the American team. But in the American team, they had Justin Thomas, Max Homa, all these guys. And now, latterly, they've gone on. You know, such fantastic careers.
After you sort of, some players. Time,
yeah, they're all right, yeah. Aren't they?
It didn't look such a bad defeat now when you look back at it, because, you know, such fantastic players. And Jordan Cena had Cam Shinkwin and Matt Fitzpatrick. So, you know, some players that have gone on and done really well there. But it sort of just kind of snowballed to the effect that, you know, I think 2014, not such an amazing year. And then, I put it all back together. Yeah, 2015, Jordan played Europro, ended up winning the Order of Merit there in a playoff against Aaron Rye. And then it was Challenge Tour, and second event he won on the Challenge Tour. And then from 15 to 2017, it was like...
It literally, you know, went like that, though, didn't it?
Yeah, it was amazing. He just, you know, got in a fantastic groove, and anything seemed possible. And, you know, he's a fantastic ball striker, and he could, you know, at the time he was, you know, shooting some great scores, and that was, you know, that was fantastic. So it was kind of, yeah, hanging on to Jordan's coattails on the way up there. And, you know, I think one of the, do yourself down, but when people say, oh, you know, what was the one thing that, you know, you felt like you did well with Jordan, and it was, for me, it was like, well, I didn't mess him up, yeah, which was kind of funny.
He got better.
He got better. You know, you couldn't look back and say, well, there was this one time we got to do this one swing drill and that turned it around. It's not, I think we're all in, you know, as golfers, we're like, oh, what's the secret? What's that one thing? But it's, you know, and it's one of those things, like, you know, it's those incremental improvements, those little 1% at the time, you know, we hit one extra fairway around, you hit one extra green, take one less putt, and it starts to, you know, trend in the right direction, rather than being this big, oh, he's got the secret, you know, go and see him. There's
is that how it works when you have like a player, and then because I started not to see you as much, so I'm guessing you were more going to travel with Jordan a little bit. And then how does it then work? So you're just stood on the range, helping, not just stood on the range, but like you're drinking.
Yeah, leaning on the 6-iron on the range. Yeah. Do a lot of leaning.
You nailed that. But yeah, does that, and then And then did like someone else go, oh, look, can you have a quick look? Because their coach isn't with them. Or how does it all happen?
So at the time, so to start off, I sort of traveled to a few events in 2017. Then 2018, joined this team. So I just, you know, travel out a little bit more. So I think, yeah, early 18, Jordan has struck up. You already knew Laurie Cantor from playing Europro and being in the West region. And Laurie was good friends with Eddie Pepperell. I think I was in Oman working with Jordan, and I got a text message the weekend from Eddie. Said, hi, I'm Eddie. We'd been to dinner once before, and I can't remember somewhere. You know, it felt like a bit of a grilling at a golf swing for an hour from him and Laurie, which was it was quite fun, but it was a bit sort of a bit intense. Yeah, he said, well, could you? I'm going to be in Qatar next week. Could you have a look? Sent me a couple of times. I had a thought sort of from on the video. And then we did a few hours on the Monday of Qatar in 2018, and then on the Tuesday and Wednesday. And it ended up that he won the event, which was... which never happened. But it was, you know, it was one of the things for him, what we worked on. He felt it took one side of the golf course out of play, you know, that the ball was always going to fade for him. And he felt he suffered a little bit of a two-way miss at the time. And yeah, he took that all the way through. You know, his short game was fantastic. That was weak as well. And he's great with the putter, which you've got to be. But, you know, it was a great week at the time. And then, yeah, so went from one player to two during 2018. And Ed went on and won again at the British Masters later that year. And it was that same week Jordan finished third. So that was a really good week. Even though, you know, Sunday was bitterly cold in October, walking around soaking wet and proper, you know, all times all day. But it was really, you know, it was one of those days. It was just magic, really, the feeling of it all, you know, having two players up at the top of the leaderboard was fantastic. But yeah, it was kind of a bit like, you know, coaching back home, word of mouth, really. It's very difficult to just go out there and say, right, I'm a tour coach, come and have lessons with me. It's gonna, you know, I think like all of us, we're all a bit sort of, I guess golf pros are going to be a bit sceptical with their career, aren't they? They're not going to go and say, oh, you know, he's, you know, just because he's come out there, I'll just go and have a lesson with him. It's a case of, you know, what have you done? What do your players do? What, you know, are they good at, you know, good at what I'm looking to improve? So, yeah, luckily, word of mouth through Jordan and Laurie at the time got me working with Eddie, and that was a fantastic first year. We had, you know, he had a good run at the Open. At Carnoustie, and yeah, it wasn't plain sailing. And then, remember,
yeah. So, in terms of working on the ladies' tour, how did you get like linked in with Annabelle?
Good question. Yes. So, Jordan's manager, Duncan Maxim, who works for Hanbrick Sports, he put me in touch with Annabelle's father because they were looking for somebody to have a look at, you know, her game. She was struggling a little bit at the time. So yeah, I think it's just passed on sort of word of mouth, really. I've worked with Annabelle for a couple of years now.
I do think she's a really underrated player. Like, she swings it like absolutely pure, and you just think, why is her name not up there more often than not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fine. It's, when you're talking about individual players, it's really harsh because you don't want to say the wrong thing or you know, say, oh, they're absolutely fantastic and make them feel bad that they're not achieving what you think. But but definitely, I mean, Annabelle, fantastic ball striker, hits it, you know, good distance. She played in the men played the Saudi International earlier this year. She played pro-am with Dustin Johnson, and Claude Harmon was walking around as well. And they were saying exactly the same as you. You know, look, you know, you should be up there winning every week and playing really well. And you know, sometimes you need to hear it from somebody other than just your coach or your immediate sort of circle to sort of believe it. And I think that's the case with Annabelle. Just, you know, the bit more belief in her own ability. You know, she's really, you know, really got the game to be able to compete and get certainly get to the LPGA. And, you know, but unfortunately, this game is a shoulda, woulda, coulda. We all know people.
We've all got one of them.
We all know someone who, how did he not make it? Or how did they not, you know, he's so good. Or, you know, it's the same as, you know, see the, you know, the guys you said you saw with the hats on back to front, you know, such good ball strikers. You know, what is that? Why can't they do it? You know, and it's there's guys that, you know, they, you know, the people I see on the European tour that, you know, maybe are in some of the lower categories that get into the event late. And you look at the strength, it's just phenomenal, really. Mm. You know, they can all hit it, you know, it feels like they can all hit it 300 yards. They can all, you know, strike it pure. They all chip great. They all putt great. But it's on the day, the margins are tiny. You know, you look at the difference between, I mean, what was it last week? I suppose between missing the cut and leading was 8 shots over 2 rounds. It's not a huge amount of shots, really.
Mm. You know, no, when, it's not. You know,
yeah.
You know, you look at the variance of a club golf for week to week. You know, if you think it's 8 shots between, you know, if they play 2 rounds at the weekend, would their variance, you know, sort of lead to, you know, would they have the consistency to be making, you know, making cuts each week if the level was lower? And I think golfers can get quite into, you know, whether they make the cut or not becomes quite a big deal for them, and sort of like their kind of like their goal for the week. And if they make the cut, that's great. And then you see some of the guys, they slip off on days 3 and 4 because kind of their Olympics was making the cut, and then day 3 and 4 they're kind of like they're burnt out because they put everything into just those first 2 days. Because that's kind of like how they live their life, isn't it? Whether you make cuts or not. And then the next level of player is looking to win. And it's almost like one of those things, if you're aiming to win, is it easier to make the cut than if you make the cut and miss by one? You know, it's one of those, it's a bit like this golf psychology, isn't it? You know, if you aim small, you miss small. You know, if you aim at the flag and miss it by 5%, it's better than aiming at the green and missing it by 5%. Psychology of it.
It's interesting we've got onto this quite naturally, because funnily enough, one of the questions about is the mental side of game of the game, and it's just such a bizarre game. Like we often have conversations with friends playing golf that one week we will probably shoot the best score we've ever shot, and we're like, yeah, that's it, I've absolutely cracked it, and then the very next day you're shooting 10 more shots than you did the day before. And you're like, what's just happened? Why has that happened? Why, what is going on? And obviously if you could figure out what is going on, you'd be sprinkling the fairy dust everywhere, wouldn't you? Going, yeah, this is it. This is it. And it is a lot easier to say than to explain, I suppose. So the question we've got is, what do the pros have in place to kind of prepare for that mentally? I know we talk about the golf psychology side of things, but is there anything specific there? Do players all have different things, or is it all just as we go?
Yeah, I think the best players tend to have, probably it's not quite the right way, but in terms of they kind of lower their expectations a little bit in terms of what they're expecting from each shot and each day. They kind of don't take maybe so many rash decisions on the golf course. They're always, for the most part, they take emotionless decisions out there based on the best way to play the hole. You know, bear in mind, they're looking at playing the hole 4 times. You know, if they could play each hole 1 under 4 times for 4 rounds, you know, they're doing incredibly well.
That's my favourite stat on the old Sky Sports at the moment, is when you get to like the fourth round, you get to see how they've played the hole the 3 days before. Yeah. Where it's like birdie, par, bogey or something like that. You know, the little bit across the stat.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I like that.
It's always nice when you see quad on there or something like that.
Yeah.
You've got yourself in trouble there. I think the psychology side of it is really interesting. And that's always something I feel like I want to, you know, on my own coach, do a little bit more of. But yeah, I think there's always guys out there that will break clubs and get angry and that kind of stuff happens, and that's always kind of fixed around. That only happens when the level of play falls below what they deem is their level, if you like. It's not that they've got incredibly high levels, but it's when they hit a shot. And it might not be the worst shot you've ever seen. But it's just when it's just not no longer acceptable for them, when they reach kind of a tipping point, and then that's kind of when things hit the fan, if you like. But I kind of don't mind that sometimes. You know, I think, you know, sometimes that player might use that moment of anger to kind of give themselves a kick up the backside to perform. Other times it's just out of general malaise. I think it's better to get it out than to try and unnecessarily hold those bad thoughts in the whole time. But equally, I think, you know, you look at some of the best performers, you know, look at someone like, say, you know, look at Tiger, you know, the GOAT. He would get angry, but he'd never hit the next shot angry, if you know what I mean. He never got angry twice on one hole or carried that over. You know, he was tremendous. You know, when he hit a bad shot, he'd never hit two bad shots in a row. It's like his Tiger stats. I don't know if you've ever seen those, where when he was a younger player, he used to mark his rounds whether he had three putts, two chips, make a six on a par five. These are all things he was trying not to do, which is a bit of a sort of opposite way around of doing, but that's how he measures rounds. I think those are the things that you feel like there's a kind of unforced errors. You know, golf's hard enough already. Yeah. You know, we're going to hit shots in the trees. We're going to, you know, hit shots in bunkers. But if you can avoid, you know, three putting, taking six on a par five, certainly at these guys' level, two chips. You know, so it's always that, you know, when you're hitting a chip shot, yeah, you always see Tiger almost hold his chip, but also he's going to hit a shot. Certainly earlier in his career, when he's making shots, he's not going to have to do it twice. Mm. You know, we've all been at the bottom of the slope and not quite made it up, and it's come back to our feet. You know, it's those sorts of errors are what you see on the whole. I mean, torpos make mistakes like the rest of us, but those are the kind of things that, you know, if you're a torpo, if you're making those kind of mistakes, they're kind of schoolboys, for want of a better thing, really. So it's kind of the psychology comes off of how they played the game, how they played the week, you know, acceptance of, you know, we're going to hit some bad shots. Obviously, too many, that becomes, you know, my role. You know, we've got to sort out why we're hitting too many bad shots. But, you know, I think when the expectancy goes up or the stress goes up, that's when I think you see the psychological mistakes. Yeah. You know, when players are towards the end of the season losing their card or, you know, continuing to get, that's when you're going to start to see the psychological errors, I think, kind of compound themselves.
Do any of your players have sports psychologists that they work with as well?
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that.
That's fair. No, if you're not allowed to say that, that's fine.
There's a number of guys, you know, that do, and you know, I think, you know, I think it's one of those things is that I think it'd be pretty good to get a psychologist on. I think it'd be fantastic in terms of, you know, what they can offer. Lee Trumbleholm, who works on the European Tour a lot, works with a lot of the guys out there, Andy Sullivan and some of the other guys out there, and it's kind of it's great looking at. He always looks like he's got kind of a, he's like sort of like their uncle, kind of best mate kind of relationship with them. And that's kind of like a, when you're out there and, you know, some of these guys are traveling 6 weeks in a row, suitcase to suitcase, it's quite nice to see a friendly face out there. You know, sort of part of the coaching role as well, I think.
I was going to say,
Cowan's probably, you know, as great a swing coach he is, you know, he's also probably Henrik Stenson's best mind coach he's ever had as well. I mean, he's watched those two guys, you know, they'll be there until they turn the lights off sometimes. And it's not just hitting golf balls, it's Pete getting in Henrik's head to go and perform and play well. And, you know, that's part of it as well. You've got to try and have that sort of, that rounded sort of...
Yeah.
But do you find you do that already? Sometimes I generally think coaches, what we have to listen to sometimes is we are like help. But I do, you probably do it without even realizing, like just in terms of conversation, whether you want to kind of kick them up the bum or, you know, just chill them out a bit. I imagine you're very good at doing that without you probably even realizing it's because it's automatic for you.
Yeah, I think when you there's always that moment, you know, certainly if you're away from the tournament and you've got WhatsApp in front of you and you're like, well, how can I put this across the best possible way, rather than saying, well, I saw you hit loads of shots right into the trees today. That was rubbish. Can you do it in
your plan?
Yeah. But, you know, it's you know, can you put it across in a way, or if you're in person, it's a lot easier in person. You can kind of gauge the mood, and are they going to be in the mood to want to hit some shots afterwards to rectify it, or are there any clubs left to hit at the end with, you know, at the end of the day? Or,
you know, this so one.
I think if you were to, you know, if you were to ask a coach and say, well, what would be the ideal person to work with? You'd have someone who didn't get too up or too down, didn't get frustrated, you know, all those things. But
that's my pool noodles just arrived.
Oh, was that pool noodles?
Yeah, love them. Can't get enough of those.
Pool noodles.
Pool noodles.
Pool noodles. Pool. I saw a great one. Do you follow Steve Furlonger on Instagram? He does. He's big into ground reaction horses.
Okay.
And he was using those pool noodles, cutting them into, I don't know, 4 inches, and then in half. Mm-hmm. So it's like a semicircle on the ground.
Yeah.
And then using those as kind of a rocker for your feet to get all the feels in there. Just sort of.
I've got loads at work, so I've cut them up to about that one and put them on their left foot just for weight transfer.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
been quite interesting, and because you get that instant feel, you get that feedback, instant yeah. feedback. So yeah, I've cut loads up. That's where I have had to order another boat load.
I was still in Loughborough at work.
Yeah.
So where were we? Where were we? You were halfway through a sentence, and I'm we were talking
about
your ideal golfer to work with. I think. Yeah.
I was saying about the. They take the commentators on, you know, the PGA Tour or Sky, or, and they talk about, you know, players being kind of like a robot, you know, emotionless, you know, don't react. And for the most part, that's a great idea. But, you know, some of that, like you go back to Tiger again, because everybody knows him, in terms of, you know, sometimes he used that kind of up excitement, you know, he managed, you know, can give him extra 10 yards on a par 5 or hit some unbelievable shots. But I thought the shot that always got me, it's sort of about his strength mentally, and his stories about how he worked on that with his dad and things in some of the books and stuff. But he's at the back of, I can't remember which year, it's at the Memorial, and he's got this shot in this really heavy rough, downslope, firm green, water behind. And he's gone there, played the first shot, and he's gone sort of pretty much under it. It's gone 6 feet in front of him. And he didn't seem flicker in terms of his emotion. He's gone back into his routine, gone back to the bag, down to the ball, and then holds out for par. And then it's like the first fist pumping and all that. It's like most players, yeah. They've just done that. They'd have hit it to 10 feet and probably two putted it to double.
Yeah.
Whereas he's got this kind of, well, it, you know, when he was at his, in his pomp, I guess when things have gone so well for him, of course he was going to chip in his mind. You know, yeah. It was only 5 feet off the fringe. Of course he's going to chip in, but to everybody else, you know, think about that in the monthly medal. You've just duffed a pitch in front of you. You know, are you going to get it on the green with the next one? That's the next thing. Are you going to knife it over the back? And that's how kind of, you know, the psychology changes from golfer to golfer.
And do you find that that's the difference? Do you find that that's okay. the big difference working with like your tour players versus your club golfers? Because obviously you've been back at home over lockdown, and I've noticed you've been doing loads more stuff online and online golf lessons. Do you find, is it massively different working with a club golfer versus a tour player? Obviously there is in some bits, but.
Yeah. I think it's just massively different people. I really don't think, a tour pro is massively different to a regular, they're better at golf, or their results do that. But I think, everyone's got a different personality. If you take Eddie and Jordan, for example, Eddie will love to do drilled at home and won't hit many golf balls. So it's great if I can give him something to do that he can do in his hotel room. He won't hit so many full swing shots at a tournament, and it's all about getting the right feels for him and then sequencing and then swing matches the flight and some of his own then feels that he puts into the swing that he feels helps him control the ball. Whereas with Jordan, he's very much put the clubs in the back of the car at the end of the practice session and go home, and then that's where he kind of chills out, and golf's not the biggest deal to him when he's at home. Which one's right?
It's all down to the individual, isn't it? It's got to be. Like we're, like you said earlier on, we're all searching for this. What's this difference? What's this? What's that? And actually, it's down to every single individual. Emma always shouts at me about managing my expectations on a golf course. As a go at me all the time about it. Not that this is about me in any way, shape or form, but it just rings home because you mentioned it a couple of times, and you mentioned the feel versus real thing as well quite a while back, and I was like, but Em, I feel it's like, but so we're having that constant argument.
It's all the coaching smoke and mirrors, feel and real.
That's all we say. Got it tattooed on us.
You feel you're doing that, but you're not really doing
that. You're not
but I think the mental side of the game fascinates me. It really fascinates me because it's somebody that works in away from golf. I don't work in golf at all, but it's mental health, and we support lots of young people, and it's all about trying to figure out what's going on inside that brain to get the best out of that young person. And I see that's the same for golf as well. And it's interesting you say about, it's like having your uncle there at the course and walking around with you and having a bit of a natter and a chat, and it's helping out in other ways. The relationship you have to build with these individuals is so, so important. And I think if you can get to a place where it becomes so comfortable to discuss the issues or the problems or the thoughts that you're having, like it's second nature, it's so important. You look at, the one that springs to mind with me is DJ, when he's talking to the press or anything like that, and it's almost like he's on a different planet at times. And I just thought, this is brilliant. I'd love to be in that brain space with that much pressure on me to be able to just be like, yeah, it was all right. And you're like, oh, yeah.
What I've heard with DJ, I think there's more going on than he lets out.
Oh, absolutely.
I think he's way more intelligent than he lets out. But I also feel that he's one of the best at, that shot's just happened, and I'm moving on. Yeah. And he's also, everyone says how, about DJ and how far he hits it and how he overpowers the golf course. Yeah, he's probably one of the most conservative players hitting into the green that's on the PGA Tour. I mean, the amount of times he always leaves himself the back side of the green, a good look at a birdie. Maybe he might be a bit more aggressive on par fives, perhaps. But he's a good thinker, and him and his brother, they have a great relationship on the golf course. So there's that trust there. And he's amazing to be able to just not sweat the small stuff. Was it last year, a few weeks before he won, he went bananas through the FedEx and then won the Masters. He shot two rounds in the 80s. Missed a cut by a boatload. And how many players, if they haven't bought into that kind of, that's over with scenario, could come back from that? Everyone's saying about how bad Rory's playing now. He shot 79. But DJ, everyone sort of takes it for granted. Oh, DJ's going to be back. He's fine. But he's a person too. He's got feelings too. He's really, really good at just hitting one shot at a time and moving on, just adding them all up at the end. I mean, sure, it probably got harder when he had the chance to put the green jacket on in November.
Yeah.
It must have been, how do you deal with that? That's still, in my mind, that scares me the most. How do you deal with that? Or is it the Paul Azinger quote? It's so nervous he couldn't spit, when he was in. You could imagine that kind of all-encompassing feeling. But Yeah, I think, but that would be the way, you know, if you were to build the ultimate golfer, you know, not just how great Dustin Johnson is from tee to green and how he hits the ball, and but his demeanour, how he takes, you know, the wins and the losses, is amazing. How he just sort of flatlines it, and
incredible. It's incredible to watch. Yeah.
Do you think? Last time I saw you was at the Open at Portrush, when mm-hmm. you were just literally walking past and it was like, Simon. If you go to a driving range, so obviously our goal is to try and get on the range, which is very rare that it happens, but obviously you could just walk straight in. Have you got anyone that you just secretly want to just stare at, or you just don't? because I just think it must, like, the I love going to the driving ranges to watch them hit balls, and I'm fascinated. The tour trucks, like, they go in and they come out with all these goodies, and I'm like, wow. But just like that area is just fascinating, I think, to watch. I would stay and watch that for a good 3-4 hours if I could.
Yeah, I think that's one of those things that to start with, it was when I got there, it was like, wow, this is amazing. And you kind of like keep moving around because you think I'm in the way, or, yeah, you know, shouldn't be here, that imposter syndrome sort of scenario. And then you would find yourself, you know, sort of glancing over there, but you've got to remember you've got someone in front of you, you've got to work with, rather than watching Henrik firing 6 irons down the range, saying like the rifle's going off. But it's one of those things that I feel like I haven't watched enough of the other players, because you're kind of so in this kind of zone, like, I've got to see him, rather make sure I'm around to see him later, and then go out on the golf course with them, and then head back. And, you know, to see some of the other guys work and see how their coaches are with them, and certainly around the short game area and putting green, you know, really drills that you can see there. And that's the kind of thing that when you're in the zone and sort of in that area doing your job, it's quite difficult to take that moment, that sort of mindful moment, say, well, actually, let's just have a look and see what's going on here. You know, take some of this in a little bit more. And that was one of the things reflecting on how sort of like the last sort of 3 or 4 years have gone, with a view of going into, you know, once, you know, the European Tour is a little bit more accessible for coaches and that sort of thing, would to be a bit, spend a bit more time when I'm there to sort of have a look a bit more about, you know, a bit like during lockdown, you know, leaves on the trees, you know, getting to know your local area a little bit better than you perhaps took it for granted. It's like, take it less for granted, because, you know, this last year sort of shown you shouldn't do that. You know, you should be a bit more grateful for what you've got and sort of the opportunities that we've got there. And it's an amazing thing, you know, there's thousands of coaches back in the UK that you think would kill to be in that position to do that. So let's not take it for granted, because I think that's kind of, it's easy to, when you get into that position, to think, "Oh, this is going to go on forever." It might not.
Yeah,
it's a great point, and I think this leads nicely into a question that we've had, possibly from somebody you know. I mentioned this beforehand. Okay. I'm going to give you a bit of a challenge. No. You've got to try and guess who this is from. And
okay,
he's trying to be funny, I think. Let's put it that way. He's asked. Right. It's a two-parter, and I'll give you the second part first. Okay. What's the best thing about getting access into the players' lounge on tour, and then
you know who it is.
in brackets, if he doesn't say it's the puddings, he's lying. He loves a treat.
That's my fruit.
Who do you reckon that is?
the players' lounges are when you get the chance to go in. It's not the best thing for me. Self-restraint around a table full of food is
can
not
you
my
just
strength.
Get can you have whatever you want, can you be like could you that's like a buffet.
Well, it's a buffet, isn't it? So, you know,
like Zaza,
you've got to make
bizarre.
Your own decisions. I'm dreadful. I can't think. There's a number of people who probably that could be, to be honest.
This might help a little bit more. Please ask Shanksy who his favourite roomie is during normal times.
Oh, this is from Rob Hopkinson, isn't it?
That's it, yeah. Yes. Lots of laughy faces.
Jordan Eddie's studio, yeah. But yeah, it's a strange one with Rob, actually. So he started working with Jordan just before Euro Pro or around that sort of time. And we sort of got to know each other. He's from Harrogate and we didn't know each other at all. And then as tournaments went on, we sort of travelled out a bit more and saw each other at events, and when we came to Bowood and just started chatting, and we'd share the same birthday. So the same, he's a bit older than me. I know, but it's, 10th of September, and we've got the same birthday, and we're both married to Sarah. Not the same Sarah, but...
I was going to say, that's weird.
And what was the other one? Oh, and his daughter's called Jess, and my eldest daughter's called Tess. It's just a bit really strange. So, yeah, we get on really well, and, he tries to keep me in line when I'm away, making better decisions. I've got a lot better. I think the first year, certainly tested out the waistband of my trainers the first couple of years I was out there. A little bit too easy to take the pudding, the chocolate pudding, the mousse or whatever.
I knew I had to slip that question in somewhere because I knew it would be a good one.
It's like, it's got to go now, thank you.
My waistline is no longer a mystery to my wife now.
No, I feel your pain because I'd be all over the pudding tray as well, don't worry. I'd be all over it.
There's got to be some benefit from being away all the time.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So we have got quite a few little questions for you from little people. Little people, I don't know.
Little people. Tiny people.
Don't know why I've said that. Well, they'll probably end up editing that out as well. So basically, we've got a couple of questions. I'll put them at you. Try and give the best answer as possible, and we'll see where we go. So to actively improve, what would you say is a good ratio of practice to playing? And I feel like you've almost answered this with what Eddie does and what Jordan does in their different ways, but I think this is probably more aimed at the amateur golfer than the...
I think at different times you probably get a different answer, but I think a really good split depends where you are in the development. I mean, if you're really struggling, say, with a big slice and getting the ball off the tee, probably not the time best spent on the golf course if you're constantly be looking for golf. If your game's kind of in a position where you feel like on the range this is going pretty good and I'm feeling pretty happy, I'd like to see players get out on the golf course and start building, really working on getting that score going and being able to take advantage of the holes that, maybe you could, par, birdie, or, and just making those decisions where you're not making double and, like we talked about, three putts and the two chips and those kinds of things, making those errors that are just kind of errors playing the game as a sort of like you play Monopoly. We all understand how to play Monopoly.
Yeah.
Like, I think a lot of people don't really understand how to play golf. They know how to hit a golf ball, but they don't really, if the flag's at the front of the green, they miss it front in the bunker, or flag's at the back, they miss it long, or, that kind of not making the sensible shots. We all played with sort of like the wily older player that just really knows how to play golf, and you go, that was net 65. It's like, really? You didn't hit any good shots, but you didn't hit any bad shots. It's that kind of, that skill of getting the ball in the hole. I think we all get a bit too into technique, how we do it. It's just, can we get onto the course and put it in? And then maybe when you are on the range, take some of those, instead of that block practice, can you do a bit more, do some sort of practice to help you transfer it onto the golf course, play nine holes, or, don't just hit 5 7-irons in a row. You're going to hit a 7-iron, then you're going to hit a short pitch, then you're going to hit a long drive. Change your targets, change your shot.
Got delivery.
Sorry, have you got a delivery of anything rocking up soon?
No, I'm all right at the moment.
Your Amazon delivery?
No, well, God, I think he comes here every day.
So with your, are you due to go back out anytime, but are you allowed to travel, or are you just not at the moment?
Difficult to say. It's really tricky. I don't even know if the schedule is very solid for the next few months. So I'm kind of really keen to do some more work at Bowood, but I'm also very mindful of I want to be in position to be able to travel. So I was chatting with Steve Astor the other day about this, and I was saying, look, I really want to commit to this, but I also need to commit to that. Mm. And that's why I got into the online coaching, was to kind of have some more dimensions to my business rather than just feeling like I got into a habit of sort of relying on coaching on tour in terms of that's who I am now.
Yeah.
And I felt like there's part of me that when I was relying on that, I'd missed that sort of one-to-one with somebody who wanted to get better and get on a bit of a journey. Whereas when you're coaching on tour, it's kind of, you are on that journey, you are trying, but there is also that element of stress and you've got to play well this week, or you know, we missed a cut last week, we've got to play better this week, or we need to fix this, or there's an element of pressure there from the player or outside of the player from other areas. So it's kind of like, and you know, the rewards are great from doing it, but it's sometimes like, it'd be nice to go back to developing that one-to-one relationship where there's not a caddy, there's not a psychologist, there's not a physio, there's not a manager.
It's just you both, isn't it?
Just the two of you just trying to get better. And I did that a little bit more last summer when we came back out the last time, and really enjoyed that, being back at Bowen, and I like being there. And
Bowen's so lovely though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. And I think that's, again, you take it for granted that, you know, that's where you are, and you think, well, actually, if I was at that club, I wouldn't have this facility to use, and I wouldn't have that range, or so, you know.
Never been. I've never been.
It's lovely. It is.
I'm
going
to have to get there. I'm moving to Wick on Monday, which is not, it's only like a 15 minute drive from Chippenham. So it's not going to be miles away. Bowood.
It's not miles.
So
it's,
no.
I've got to sort myself out and go over there. Yeah.
Definitely. We'll do that.
With Ben, Ben Emerson, so I follow him on Instagram just because. He joined Bowood, and just the photos alone, I could just stare, and it always looks immaculate. Like when I went for Tiff's wedding there, like they just know how to do a wedding, and the golf course is always immaculate. Robbie Williams joined there, so that made me go, like, I want to join there.
It's a cracking place. It's a great golf course. Probably on the tougher side of things, you know, there's lots of bunkers in front of greens, quite narrow spots where you want to hit driver. The rough can get quite long in the summer, but it, you know, if you want to go and test yourself, it's somewhere that you can go and do that. But all equally, it's a good fun place, and it's in fantastic. The grounds, the old capability brown estate, sort of leaf, you know, old trees and sort of landscape and through there, so it really does make the most of you know, its surroundings. Yeah, and since the hotel's been put in as well, it's got a lot busier.
It's lush.
I have to get out there. I've got to mention it. The delivery is golf related.
Ooh, what is it?
I've gone for
a training aid. Oh no.
Ah! Head cover, nice.
New head cover.
John Daly.
It is a John Daly. I've been trying to get one with, I've got one with gold hair already, a gold mane. Oh, right. But trying to get one with a rainbow mane has been near impossible to get hold of. But now I've got one for driver and three wood. They're going to be back.
Oh, perfect.
So golf geek within. Where did we get to with the question? I can't remember where we were because I was getting a bit excited over John Daly's head cover there.
We just finished talking about Bowood, didn't we?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry. So, yeah. Back to the that ratio of training, well, not training, practicing to playing. Yeah. There's no real right answer unless you kind of know where you're at yourself. So, it's a funny one, isn't it? I think it comes back to that individual athlete, golfer, if you like, all the time. And if you're struggling with that, go and see somebody and talk to somebody in terms of a club professional, your golf coach or whoever, and they'll point you in the right direction. Hopefully, it's probably the best answer.
I think so. I think Yeah, it's, I think if I was, you know, if you get someone comes through the door, the first thing that I would look at is that, you know, in an ideal world, you spend a long time with them in terms of, you know, see them play, see how they practice, get their pat, but that's not, you know, for everyone, that's not going to be possible. With them, and I think the thing you've got to look at the player and think, well, how can I help this person enjoy their next round of golf more? And usually that's having less shots. So what's the biggest waste of shots? You know, if you think right, let's go from the tee first. Well, if they've got a shot where they, you know, two or three times around they're losing a ball, that there's a bunch of shots you could just improve them straight away there. So, you know, what's causing that? What's the big sort of big miss? What's the big chunk that we could get away, you know, they could call it low hanging fruit, if you like. You know, what's the easiest thing we could change? So that, you know, that would be the first thing I would look at, you know, and once they're getting rid of that sort of, you know, I think Butch Harmon would call it the cancer in their golf swing. If you can get rid of that, and then they're starting to play golf, then I think it becomes a bit more skill based. You know, can you improve their skills? You know, can they control how far the ball flies, you know, inside 100 yards and around the green, and can they stop the ball where they want it to on the putting green?
So really quickly, and I know this is a horrible question. Do you ever as coaches, both, this is Rama as well, if she can listen still.
Yeah.
Do you ever get that golfer that you look at and think, this is a horrible question. Is there literally, you look at, is there no hope for this person to ever play golf? Or do you have that feeling that actually, doesn't matter who you put in front of me, we're going to make them a half decent, we can make them a half decent golfer? Or if some people got it, or some people just haven't got the ability to play golf, or is that, does that even really matter? Do you understand what I'm trying to say? Do you ever get that?
I always like a challenge. I always believe that you can get there in the end. You can always help somebody, whereas you just might have, you know, I've always felt in my own coaching, I've always had more than one way to fix something. I think that's, we've all got, you know, as golf coach, I think Emma, you'd agree, is that you've got to have more than one way to fix the slice, you've got to have more than one way to fix the hook, you've got to have more than one way to help somebody pitch. You know, you've got to have a sort of an arsenal to be able to call upon. And then with that individual in front of you, you've just got to slowly work through the ways of overcoming that.
Yeah.
And usually it's a lot more simple than people think, in terms of it's usually a lot about, you know, club face and grip and how they move their body, how they pivot is massively influential how the ball flies. I think we can all get really into that kind of style of it. You know, I think everyone wants to make the swing look good, but I think really if you get dig deeper and, you know, can you get it to, you know, function? I think that's the key. But I don't think I haven't met anyone who haven't. There's nobody there I've dreaded thinking, oh, this guy's never going to get better. I think there's always a better way, as long as they're happy to practice.
We've mentioned this before, haven't we, Em, that golf is probably the most inclusive sport ever anyway, just because of the handicap system, and anybody can go and play. And obviously, well, I'm from more of a rugby background before golf, and it's a very small window that you're able to play rugby without it becoming pretty dangerous and you getting left behind, or the skill level's not there and you're going to get them really hurt. And that's what I love golf. Like, the fact that I loved it so much, you can just, anybody can play at any time, at any point, and you can still have a round and have some great fun. And it doesn't matter whether it's hyper competitive or whether you're just going around for a beer with your mates. I think it's really, really, it's just a brilliant sport for that. Inclusivity is perfect. It's perfect.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting to bring up rugby there, because if you look at, say, if you took rugby 20 years ago and when it sort of first went professional, maybe 25 years ago, that there was a different body shape on the pitch in every position. You could have, you know, someone who's 5 foot and 10 stone, or you could have 6 foot six and 25 stone. They could all play. And you can see in the professional game, that's disappearing, you know, that everyone kind of looks the same size. And you just wonder whether professional golf is going that way.
I think we always bring him up because I know we brought him up on this conversation before on the podcast, and it's Jonah Lomu was probably the first example of a professional rugby player. And I always try and picture what Jonah Lomu would look like now if he burst onto the scene in comparison to what it was then. Would he just fall back into place with everybody else? So basically what I'm trying to, are we playing rugby now with 15 Jonah Lomus on a pitch, or was it just he was that good, he would stand out again? He probably would stand out in some aspect because he was an absolute monster. But he was truly probably the first professional athlete. Not it's just because of his physical presence and being able to be 19 and a half stone or whatever he was, running 100 metres in less than 11 seconds is like pretty terrifying when you're another winger standing opposite him, 12 stone, dripping wet or what have you.
Exactly. You look at Tiger, probably the first golf athlete, really, who really sort of changed the game in that regard. And you can see the players that are successful now are kind of like mini versions of him, aren't they, in some regard.
DeChambeau, Blimineck, they showed a photo of him from like 3 years ago, and they showed a photo of him at, I think, wherever it was, the Masters. That man has worked his bum off, or added bum on, to get where he's got to. I mean, the work ethic that man has got is incredible, really.
He does look like he's eaten his old self, doesn't he?
Oh, crazy. It
took that 3 months of lockdown, and I know the process for him started a lot earlier, but he would say that the journey sort of been sort of more like 18 months to 2 years, but it was that 3 months, and then he came back out and played at the Colonial or something, and all of this monster.
Where's he come from?
Yeah. But I think, going back to golf being included, I think I took it in terms of like rugby at the top end, kind of, it doesn't look quite so inclusive in terms of like if you took body shapes and types. And I just wonder whether professional golf might be going that way as well. If you look at everyone's becoming a bit more physical, and are you going to have the players that are a bit shorter, don't hit it quite so far? Are they going to be able to compete?
Well, if you look at some of the... I didn't mean to cut you off there, Simon. I mean, if you look at just some of them already, and you like mentioned the Brooks Koepkas and the Tony Finaus and the Bryson DeChambeaus, Rory McIlroy's, they're all big, fit guys. I know McIlroy's a bit on the shorter side, but he's still a big, ripped guy. They're all athletes. They're all athletes. Yeah. But then what I also love about the fact is that you've still got the older guys still competing. Like Lee Westwood, the last couple of weeks or months, or over the last month, has been in ridiculous form, and he's still competing. And the fact that we've got this rivalry between Bryson and Lee Westwood that no one saw coming is brilliant. And that's why I just love golf because of it. It's brilliant. It's fantastic.
But then if you see Justin Thomas, when he won the other week, it was showing you his like what he does in the gym. I mean, that man works out. He just doesn't bulk out with it, but physically, he is like so fit, even though he doesn't look like the DeChambeaus of the world. It is amazing.
He's incredibly efficient when he hits a driver. I mean, he gets the absolute most out of his swing speed. You know, he just puts it all on there. You can't say he's out there at 85%. Remember when gives him a first lesson. Oh, you've just got to hit it 80%. Don't. That's not a bit of advice anymore. Yeah. Certainly at that level, you know, you can't be leaving too much. Even too much behind, but I think the three of us could go and have a game and play on any golf course. You could play on the same golf course that the Open's played on, that Rory's played on. You can't go and play on Twickenham, can you?
We said this last week. You can literally walk in. You can literally walk into a professional golfer's shoes for the day or the morning or however long you're playing, and stand on the same tee as that person, the same green, and the same position in the fairway, and be like, right, I can truly compare myself to some of the best in the world. And 9 times of 10, I do hit an awful shot. But it's still that, I'm getting a feeling for what it is. And like you say, you can't go and play it to it. Even though I've played at Twickenham, funnily enough. But no, this is not a self-brag, because it is actually a hilarious story. Because, and this is really off topic golf-wise, but do you follow Bristol Bears very often?
I just recently watched this clip from one of the forwards.
Yeah, I can't remember his name either. It's gone viral, hasn't it? They're like absolutely hilarious. Well, going back a few years, probably before I started playing golf, I got asked to be, they've got this mascot called Brizzly Bear. I got asked to be Brizzly Bear once, and I was like, yeah, I'll do it, whatever, I'll do that for a bit of a laugh. Anyway, what I didn't end up realising, this ended up becoming a regular thing, and I was running around dressed as this, in this bear suit. I'll send you a photo afterwards, in this bear suit, doing the worm and sliding down rails, stealing people's pasties and pints off of them when the game was going on, all just for this bit of a laugh. And they pay me a bit of money for it and give me a free pasty at the end of every game. I can't figure out why I kept doing it. Anyway, this kept going on, and it ended up leading to this end of year premiership kind of do. When it was a premiership final, they invited all the rugby mascots down. So I got this invite to Twickenham, and I played in this sevens rugby game at Twickenham, and I was dressed as Brizzly Bear. It was the most hilarious thing. I can remember this. this is ridiculous. This Harley the Bear, which is Harlequin's bear, tried to pull my head off in the game, like pull my mascot head. And I was like, sacrilege. Like, who the hell do you think you are? You're going against all the mascot codes. Like, what are you doing? So I thought, do you know what? Unbeknown to everybody else, I weigh a bit. I was playing rugby still at the time. So I thought, well, I'm just going to smash Harley Bear. Harley Bear's having it. Absolutely having it. So Harley Bear caught the ball. I lined the bear up, hit with all my might, picked the bear up, dumped it on its head, did look like rubbed it, like all of that. Got back into the change rooms afterwards. It's about 5'1" young girl that was Harley the Bear. I'm like, oh, brilliant. And I was like, I'm really sorry about that. She's like, yeah, I think we're going to feel it in the morning. I was like, yeah, Jesus. So yeah, nearly killed Harley the Bear at Twickenham. So that's the end of my rugby Twickenham career.
That's fantastic.
Back to the golf.
Very quickly.
All of that. We've got another question from, you know, Joe, little Joe. I call him little Joe Watkins. Advice for somebody looking to eventually to make it pro. What tournaments do they need to get on to, tours? What's best to join? How do you get into all of that sort of stuff? I don't know whether he's aiming this at himself. He's a good little golfer, but maybe, possibly.
Well, to me, there's no one way to do it. And I just sound like I've copped out completely, but there's no direct route, if you like. There is, I mean, if you take Jordan's route, for example, he went, sort of England golf, GB and I, didn't go straight onto the tour, took a bit more time, then EuroPro Challenge Tour, European Tour. And he was leading up to that as a junior, he'd be playing a few junior opens, but then it'd get into more Faldo series and then some of the bigger national events. Sort of bigger amateur events around the country, sort of Lytham Trophy, that's at Andrews Links, south of England, down at Walton Heath, that kind of scenario. But then you have, some other players who haven't done that, because up until recently, the great thing is that you could, I don't know if you still can through Q School, get a European Tour Cup. Maybe you can. I know you can't on the PGA Tour, that goes straight to Corn Ferry, but you could go and have the week of your last six rounds in PGA Catalunya at the time and get a European Tour card. And before that, all you had to do was obviously be a good player, but pay the money and then get into the event. So that was kind of like, you have the week of your life and you've got a European Tour card, and you've changed your life altogether. So there's a bit more of a sort of way you can always parachute yourself in onto the European Tour if you play really great for more than 6 days, so you've got the Q scores beforehand. But if you're a young player, you've just got to get out there, get used to scoring low. If that's in a junior open, boss the junior opens in your area during the summer. If you're then getting to that level where your handicap's low enough to be playing some bigger events, get out there and boss those as well. Because it's came, whatever you're doing, whatever you're playing, you've got to learn how to win.
Yeah.
I think if you get onto the European Tour and not be a winner, at some level, it's going to be really tricky to back yourself to then all of a sudden, because otherwise you're just playing for places the whole time, and it's going to be a long,
yeah,
a long affair trying to just pick up enough points to keep the card. If you've got to, see at any level, any sport, you know, you've got to be a winner and get that kind of that hunger to just will the ball in the hole and make it happen when you need to. I mean, that was a great thing about Jordan's career. When he really needed it, you know, to get from EuroPro to Challenge Tour, you know, he won a playoff and made it happen. You know, he won early on the Challenge Tour. When he had the opportunities, he held those pucks and it made it happen. The first chance he had of winning on the European Tour, he was in a playoff, he held that puck but won the event. So it's, you know, and when you have those chances and make it happen, that's kind of, you know, what it is. And get yourself in that mindset of making it happen.
It's trying to get used to those pressure situations, isn't it?
And
having that winning mentality, just I want to win so bad that I'm going to make this happen. And it kind of rings true with the amateur golfer a little bit. I'm only saying this from personal experience again, that I got used to shooting my best scores. I'm not a very good golfer, but best scores. But I couldn't repeat that when it came to playing in like a club competition. Like when I was playing match play, I couldn't do it. I was like, I was so focused on that other person stood over there that I'm trying to beat that I couldn't even focus on my own game. And it's the same when it comes to whether it was a match play event or whether it was the medal or Stableford, whatever was going on. I was so focused on people around me rather than doing what I was doing. And so practice makes perfect when it comes to those things, definitely.
Yeah, I think that could be in how you practice, or, you know, luckily people call it training now, which I think is probably a better description. You know, we train in football, we sort of practice golf. Whereas I think if you sort of train yourself in terms of, you know, like I said about, you know, spacing out your practice a little bit more, varying in what you do, so it's a bit more game-like rather than just hitting balls and then all of a sudden going onto the golf course and expecting it to be better. Just try and simulate that game-like scenario a bit more often. I think, and that's why I think latterly thinking about getting on the golf course more than being on a range is going to be really great, because that's where the game is. You know, it is on the golf course, so let's practice on the golf course. Let's get comfortable hitting shots out there. Can you feel comfortable hitting a certain shot on a certain hole? Have you got some holes out that you don't feel too good? Well, why don't you try a 3-wood on that hole or a 5-wood? Or, you know, if it's a longer par 4, you know you can't reach it in 2. Well, let's play it comfortably with 3 shots rather than feeling like we've got a bus driver every time and half the time we're losing a golf. That kind of the way you think about it. And then get comfortable in your own skin. And that's how you're going to play the game. It's almost like you go out there and you think, well, I want to shoot this, so I've got to be this kind of golfer rather than, well, how can I get the most out of this player? Yourself, how can I just play my game, hit the shots I can play? If there's a shot out there that you've not practiced, what are you doing trying to pull it off? Yeah, we've all done it. We all think, oh, let's try a Phil Mickelson lob shot over this bunker, this sandy lie, because the sand's blown out, and the next shot's a plugged bunker shot, rather than think, well, you know, could I play a shot, you know, more towards the back of the green and take 2 putts from there, rather than, you know, playing a shot that I've never played, or cut it under the trees because, oh, I think there's a gap.
Oh. Yeah, can't hit a 40-yard wide fairway, but you're aiming for a gap that big. You're like, I've got it.
Yeah, I've got the secret. But going back to that younger player, it's like, you know, if anything, you know, that was learned from working with Jordan and his sort of journey would be, you know, get yourself a good relationship with a coach that you trust and you get on with, and then just start to really, you know, schedule out what you're trying to achieve, you know. And don't get too bogged down in, right, I'm trying to get to the European Tour. Well, take that back. Well, to start with, I want to be the best player at my club.
Yeah.
You think, if I'm going to be the best player at my club, and then say, what does that look like? What do I need to improve? And kind of look at it kind of a bit more structured, rather than you make a goal and then all of a sudden that goal becomes so heavy. It's like, you know, for me, it's like, I want to weigh this. And instead of just doing this daily habit of what's going to help me do that, I'm just thinking about that number the whole time. So, I can't eat. Yeah. I can't do that. I've got to do it. And you just get lost rather than going, right, just all about habit, process, kind of all the boring stuff you hear Johnny Wilkinson talk about when he's talking about England rugby, but it's so true that if you commit to the process, the goal kind of, you'll get to the goal or you'll get somewhere close to it. But if you keep aiming at the goal, it's quite tough, I think. Almost becomes encompassing.
I'm going to not pick on Emma a little bit, but discuss Emma, because goal setting is a conversation. It's a topic of conversation quite often, isn't it, Emma? Because it's something that we use at work with the young people, and we always talk about that smart target and that young, and we try our hardest. And I think right at the start of, was it this season or the year? Well, after New Year's, all you see over social media is, what's your goal for this year? What's your target? And it's just reams and reams of people that are, like you say, creating this monster of a goal or a target that's, well, it's not going to be completely unachievable, but you're going to have to be doing the best goal for your life to even achieve it. And you're just like, like you said, where does it go? So we try, for work stuff, for the kid, the young people that we work with, we have one big one, but we kind of forget about that and create loads of little ones that are going to help us get to that place. And Emma has been really good that with me, instead of me going, well, I just want to shoot under par, mind. I want to do this.
I think you actually said that yesterday, Ben.
I did say that yesterday. I was like, "Oh, do that this year, shoot under par." But Emma will take that and laugh and take the mickey out of me. But I know the next time I go and see her, we're thinking about something else. And the sensible brain tries to kick in. But
do you think working with tour players versus like club players? For me, I think working with like expectations of those players is a biggie for me, because I think you'll get people that think they are better potentially, and they watch the TV, they watch all these videos, and they think they should be doing this and think they should be doing that. And whereas really, like you said about kind of reining it in a little bit and just playing with what you've got, do you find that a bit? Yeah.
100%. I think some of the better players that I've ever seen are always players that play their game and know their game the best. They're not trying to be, not trying to be Bryson. They're not trying to be, Nick Faldo with a laser like irons all the way around. They're not trying to, hold everything it's just trying to understand what your strengths and weaknesses are as a player. And then you've just got to try and take that and then put that on top of the golf course and try and get it to fit as best you can. If you're not a particularly great driver of the ball, but you've read on Twitter that if you don't hit driver off the tee, you're losing strokes gained off the tee. So you're going to lose a lot of strokes gained if you hit the provisional every hole. It might be that, for a while you're just getting the ball in play and enjoying it more that way. What's the best way you can enjoy the game? And then, because lower scores are going to help you enjoy the game, aren't they? So it's a case of, find some way of getting some confidence to play the game. And I think there's a bit of pressure out there from things you do see on social media. There's a bit of a thing in terms of, everyone's up at 130 with their driver and lifting weights and, in that side of things. And I think you'd be a bit foolish if you're the wrong guy to see that as the best way to improve your handicap. It's quite a one-dimensional way, but that is kind of like another mini sector of the business, isn't there? Well, there were putting coaches and specialist short game coaches. I think there's going to be, a bit of a growth in a specialist kind of swing speed driver coaches. But there is a reason why, there's long driving competitions, because that is like a bespoke swing and part of golf. Not getting the ball in the hole. They have eight shots, and one has to go in the grid, and that's what they're looking for. Bryson's challenged that a little bit, but I don't know if you watched the players the other week when he had a chance to win. Right, he had to eagle the last, which is a tough ask on that hole with water all there. But he hit a 4-iron off the last hole because he knew that he couldn't fit his driver onto the fairway where he wants to hit the golf ball. So he hit a 4-iron, and then, I suppose his 4-iron still went 250 or 260, but or maybe even further, but he still had a shot in. So
they took the left side of the lake OB as well, didn't they? Just for,
exactly,
for
yeah.
to stop him hitting the driver.
I'd have let him hit it, to be fair.
Oh, absolutely. You know, yeah.
It'd been great for TV, wouldn't it? I mean, let's see how he's gonna land it on this area of rough. I don't know, maybe he would have got line of sight from the where all the people were sitting, all the sort of hospitality units and stuff. I mean, I think it would have made it interesting, maybe dangerous for people playing nine, but it would have made it interesting. But you know, so even someone who's got firepower like Bryson DeChambeau there could have hit potentially a 350-yard drive and it could have run out somewhere close, you know, within 50 yards, could have pitched it on and maybe made an eagle through holding a pitch shot. Even he didn't let his kind of expectations overshadow how he managed his self-way around the golf course there.
Yeah.
He still understood that eagle's really unlikely, so seconds not terrible. You know, it's still 1.5 million for him. So, you know, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah, and we're,
you know, so if that guy, you know, that club member who, you know, has hit the ball 300 yards once, is trying to, you know, carry the water hazard on his next medal that was his 1% shot.
Mm.
You know, is that the play? You know, you watch most of the guys, you know, playing European Tour week in, week out, they're going to be giving it full beans off the tee, but if there's not the room to fit the driver down there, they're not going to play the shot.
Yeah.
If it has it on one side, out of bounds on the other, it might lay back to where there's a bit more room, you know, rely on their longer game or their short game. So yeah, I think expectations are, I think everyone sees the last five groups on a Sunday and what they do and think that's how you play golf. Whereas if you were to watch, that's why I think the PGA Live that's on Sky, that during the day it picks on, you know, a group of three, sometimes a, you know, top ranked players or sometimes a sort of mid ranked players. Just watch how that's just live golf. They're not at the top of the field. Just see how they get round. And it's not pretty the whole way around. They're not hitting fairway green. You know, it's, you know, they're using their short game, they're using their, you know, they're grinding away. It's not just, you know, I think we get this sort of highlights package of how, you know, how golf's meant to be played, and I think we think that's how to do it.
That's a really good point, because we see the best of the best on the telly all the time, don't we? You see, oh, yeah, look at that, he's just nailed that, he's done this, he's done that, or she has done that and done this, and you're thinking, yeah, blimey, we've got to be like that to be the best on the telly. But actually, you don't see all the bad shots that often, unless they are a really, really, really bad shot, yeah, just because they're going to see something wonderful happen. But that also, yeah, for me, that also happens on the old social media platforms as well, because we've got, yeah, loads of people just putting up their best shots that they've ever hit. And yeah, people think, I know social media is a bit like this for everyone, not just golfers. It's, people see the best life of everyone. They think, geez, mm, I've got to be that to be able to compete with these people. And actually, you don't see the other 60 shots that they've hit all over the shop. You just seen that one,
exactly,
flushed. And
yeah,
and those expectations, because I know we do create them ourselves in our own head, but if you're seeing that all the time, it's really hard not to create that expectation of being so high. Yeah. You think, I've got to compete. And especially somebody like me who's really competitive, I want to make sure that I'm competing with somebody. And I see that all the time, like, Jesus, I can't compete with that. Then it just breaks you down in a different way completely. But we won't go into that, because yeah, I might have a little bit of an emotional breakdown there.
Well, no, I started working with a new player, and to be honest, to start with, we've only worked online, and he's playing on the European Tour these last 2 weeks. And one of the things I've been saying to him, I said, well, you just, you know, I think it's quite easy to fall into that perfection mode. You know, yeah, Instagram, that kind of, and I sort of borrowed a bit of Denzel Washington from The Equalizer. He's working with the big security guy. He wants to get the security job, and he's training him. He says, "Well, just look for progress, not perfection." And I thought, you know, I know it's a bit of a cheesy movie, and
brilliant,
a great couple of hours, and everyone needs a bit of Denzel in their life in terms of when it comes to motivational speaking. But that progress, not perfection. I think if you were to take that and give that to someone who wants to be really good in any sport, and it comes back to those habits and those micro goals, if you like. If you're just looking for progress, if today you hit 20 balls And yesterday you only hit 10, there's some progress there. If you hold six more putts from 5 feet than you did yesterday, some progress. If you can start to measure that. Well, yeah, and if you can start to measure that and start to feed your own confidence from those kind of small wins, I think life is a lot easier than going, right, you know, it's like Emma and I's lesson book. If you say, right, okay, I've got 10 lessons in the diary, next week's not looking good. And instead of thinking, right, I want 50 lessons in there for next week, go, well, today, if I can, you know, work my day to baseball, speak to a few people online, if I can add another lesson to that, that would be 10% more than I had yesterday. And then you can slowly do it like that. It's the same as in any workplace. And if we can do a little bit more, or, you know, anything in life that you want to improve on, rather than getting really stuck into, like, what does it look like? I can let those small gaps. And that's the book by James Clear, Atomic Habits. I don't know if you've ever read that one. It's a fantastic book. It talks about just small habits and growing on them and kind of making them part of your day. And it goes into the really, you know, minute detail of how to do it and get the most out of your own technology around the house and how it can help you almost not forget to do it. It just becomes part of your life. And he's got this email that I signed up to ages ago, but every Thursday he comes up with these small, short emails with three, I think it's called 3-2-1 Thursday or something like that. And it's just, I think there's three quotes, two stories and one thought for the day or something like that. But they're really good in terms of helping you just take action, but small action. I think you saw these guys on social media, you know, you've got to take action. These life coaches say you've got to do this, you've got to do that, make the most of it. But he's very much a case of, well, just make small incremental change, a bit like James Brailsford, the cycling guy who took on Sky Cycling and GB Cycling. He was all about incremental changes and those small one percenters. If part of your end goal to get into the European Tour, part of that, you feel like you need to reflect better at the end of your practice, what went well, what didn't go well. One of those small changes might be, I'm going to write a sentence in a journal after my practice. Well, I hit lots of shots to the right today. But then the next time you might go, well, the next time you practice, if you write two sentences, you know, so small things, and you start to react to them and start to focus on change rather than go to the range every time. Right, I've got to break 80 this week. I've got to break 80 this week.
It's overwhelming, isn't it?
Yeah, it becomes a bit desperation, doesn't it? You know, it's like, you know, you go into it, it's like going into an exam, just thinking, I've got to pass the exam rather than doing the revision. You can't just go into a mindset, I'm going to pass this exam. You've got to do the work first or the small bit. I'm not saying that I'm very good at doing those sort of things in my own life, but it seems like there's tangible ways of being able to do it. And it's kind of the small habits that become really things that help people on their journey to reaching their goals rather than just focusing on the goal.
Less is definitely more, isn't it? You're teaching me that. Instead of me going to the range and being a Gatling gun, just like, boom, boom, 250 balls in the space of about 20 minutes, actually, I don't even hit 50 balls when I go to the range anymore. I only get a couple and work on what I need to work on and disappear. But again, that has helped me no end. Like, the shots have dropped off my game loads, and we didn't even play off the year last year, and that's just because of COVID and that, and that's all the stuff that Emma's been doing with me.
That's great.
That's why I really appreciate that.
Thanks, Ben.
That's right. It's working on the right stuff rather than just throwing volume at it. You know, you can get better through 20 balls of doing the right stuff than 200 balls of no focus. Session, you've got to have what are you going to get out of today? What are you going to try and what's that goal for that hour rather than what's the goal for the next 365 days?
I would challenge any amateur golfer to come up with that, because I guarantee most of my friends that play will just go, oh, I'm just going to go to the range for an hour. And what are they doing apart from just hitting balls? And they might, I'm like, there's 100 sign down. I might hit that. I might just try and hit that. And then just, that's all that happens. And you're not actually thinking about what you're doing in your swing, what you're doing here, what you're doing there. I think, not that we're lazy. Is it lazy? Is that the best way of putting it? I don't know if it is. It's just maybe.
It's just habit though, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe we haven't had the right support to get us towards that mindset that we're talking about just now. I think, it's really important, isn't it, that we get, well, keep sharing the word, spreading the word, and get people thinking on the right track. I'm also getting really conscious of time because we are talking.
It's Thursday.
We are going to cut a lot out of that because we've messed up some of the editing stuff, problem. But don't worry about it. But they're really quickly, we got our bog standard questions. Emma, do you want to fire away first?
To be fair, Ben, I don't actually remember it.
It's all on me. It's all on me. Yeah,
I thought loads today. My brain has been ticking today and I'm like, oh.
So they're literally just questions we ask everyone, Simon. They're not particularly strenuous, they're just little fun ones. So basically, you've got best course that you've ever played.
St Andrews,
not Old Royal course. West Wales.
close second.
All right, and then course that you haven't played but you want to play, the most desirable course that you want to play. You're not allowed to say Augusta because everybody says Augusta.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's a tricky one. I really liked to have had a go at the National Golf Week of America where we played the Walker Cup. That looked a lot of fun.
I'm writing them down just so for my memory. Okay, and then we're going to talk about caddies now, and you get to choose two. So you have a golfing caddy. That can be a caddy that's on the tour already or a professional golfer themselves. And then you have to choose a caddy away from golf, somebody you'd like to spend your afternoon playing golf with and giving you some advice. And it's really interesting because some people have gone really like technical and gone, well, I want to know somebody that knows their stuff. And they've gone like the Professor Brian Cox kind of way, and then others have gone, well, I just want to have a bit of a jolly, and they'll have like a comedian walking around with them or something like that. So completely up to you. So a golfer and a non-golfer as your caddy.
Tricky. Never thought about having a caddy. I don't know. Bones would have been pretty good. We've caddied for Phil Mickelson.
Yeah,
it'd be quite entertaining. Or Fluff.
Both pretty good at their job.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah.
I think maybe Steve Williams, who caddied for Tiger after Fluff, he might have been a bit too much for me.
A bit scary, I think. Yeah.
That might have been a difficult one. And sort of a non-golfing caddy kind of scenario.
Yeah.
That's difficult. It'd have to be somebody who's going to keep it light. You know, someone's going to make me laugh.
Not a Denzel then.
No, I get quite anxious on the golf course at the best of times. So I'd need someone telling me a few jokes or something like that. I think maybe something like, I don't know, it's quite cheesy, but Tim Vine, the guy who does like the one-liners.
Oh yeah, I do know. Yeah,
he's quite funny.
He is very funny.
Like dad joke.
Yeah.
So I think that'd be quite cool. Or
do you know what? Back in the day, I would have thought you'd have said like Jack Black or something. Remember you loved.
Have you seen Jack Black on TikTok? Any of his stuff? Honestly, I sent out a message the other day and I'm like, Jack Black's my spirit animal. He's like,
he's got a massive beard, hasn't he? Yeah, I've seen some of them.
Trunks, and he's pretending to be four, and they've done all this, and he's just like running around, going, giving it all of that. Hilarious. I'll send you some stuff. Honestly, it's brilliant.
Get ready for it, Simon. Get ready.
looking forward to that. An hour gone.
And then, last question then. Four ball, you get to choose your dream four ball. They can be still with us, sadly passed away, family members, golfers, non-golfers, but obviously one of them has to be you. So you get three choices, basically.
Right, okay. I did this for Bowood's website the other day, and I can't remember who I put on there now.
Just pick someone different.
I've had that. Obviously had that four ball, so I'm going to do another one now.
Yeah.
I think... gets a lot of stick for being not a very nice man, but it'd have to be Nick Faldo. He was a bit of an absolute legend in my eyes. And I don't know. Be good to watch. I'm not sure about the band.
The chat. The bants.
They did go on Vicky Fowler the other day. I thought that was quite funny. Did you see that?
No, I haven't seen it.
Someone said, oh, Ricky's missing the Masters, he hasn't qualified yet. And then from out of nowhere, Nick Faldo just wrote on the bottom, he said, oh, he can spend the whole week shooting six more adverts for TV. And it's as if he's just spending more time doing that than playing golf. I thought, shit hard.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it
is. I swear every coach would say Ben Hogan, wouldn't they? So I'd have to see Ben Hogan, see how good he was. And Seve?
Yeah, Seve would have been amazing, wouldn't he?
Is that, yeah, are they a bit cliche?
It doesn't matter. They're yours.
Yeah, they're yours.
If you want them, you can have them.
They'd be quite fun.
Seve'd be on my list, I think, just because, and the only reason he would be, because I didn't play golf, sadly, when Seve was playing or still alive. I didn't even know who he was. But I only learned about him through Sky Sports, and then that's it. I've been spent hours watching him on YouTube.
Oh, he's
epic. And it's
ridiculous,
just,
isn't it?
I just wish I'd been able to see it live at any shape or point. Well, in any shape or form. Instead of
a bit of a film star, wasn't he? But, you know, he kind of had that kind of that look.
Yeah.
And the shots he used to hit, and, you know, everyone said how bad a driver he was. Most of that was later on. He had to be a great player to do what he did in the game. But just mercurial to watch. I mean, I remember having a VHS video of Seve. It was done by Tony Jackson and somebody else. And just the shots on there. I keep trying to find like a DVD copy or see if it's streamed somewhere, but I can't see it anywhere. It's quite old. But just there was some montage of him hitting shots in there with this Spanish music and stuff. It's like, that just really got me really into playing golf. Such a shame to lose him, and someone like that around the game.
You talk about some of the shots, like off his knees, under
off
fir
his knees,
trees.
Under the bush,
and he's just like, how are you doing that? And I think, I can't remember what his caddy's name was, but he does a bit of an impression of him. He's aiming for that hole, over a wall, through a tree, and he's like telling, just brushing him away, I got this, and then he chips it
so
in.
He does,
for a
amazing.
Bird.
Amazing.
Unbelievable guy.
Yeah, that would be entertaining to see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but other than that, it's been amazing having you on. And it's been, again, like last week, I feel like I've learned a load, which is always a benefit. always a bonus.
Yeah, thanks, Simon.
Yeah, really appreciate your time. And that, I'm afraid, is it for this week's episode. But we'll have you on again at some point, I should imagine.
In a few
months' time, maybe a year's time, depending on where we go.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit more golf to talk about as well. It'd be great.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully, yeah.
Of being played, that'd be excellent.
Yeah,
I think this one's going to be quite a popular one, I think. Sorry. So I think it would be cool if and when you have time, because I know your schedule is going to be crazy. But yeah, I think if you have time towards the end of the year, that'd be wonderful if you could come back on.
Yeah, no problem. That'd be cool. That'd be cool. Good luck with the rest of the year with the podcast and things. I think you're doing a great
job.
Thank
you so much. Very daunting to start it off, but fair play to you. Good luck.
Yeah, thank you very much. And so I'll just say one last thing. Take care, guys. We'll see you next time. Bye from me. Bye from Emma, I should imagine.
Yes. Goodbye.